Those farms out there in the country may look peaceful, but in fact they are battlefields in which pests compete with farmers for the growth and development of crops. This competition leads us to ask, which will win, pests or pesticides?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1008th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Elfin Cove who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Howdy doody.
Folks, this from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Remember Lewis Carroll? Yeah, I bet you do. Well, in our country, said Alice, still panting a little, you generally get to somewhere else. If you run as very fast for a long time, as we've been doing. A slow sort of a country, said the Queen. Now, here, you see, it takes all of the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as hard. So, when genetically modified crops were introduced into agriculture, they introduced a new way for farmers to compete with pests for the growth and development of crops. Some of the GMOs were infused with a bacterial poison that killed insect pests by dissolving their stomachs. Other GMOs were given the ability to withstand herbicides that kill the weeds that compete with the crops for nutrients, sunshine, and water. Others still were given both the ability to kill insects and to withstand pesticides. This miraculous new technology allowed one farmer to grow thousands of acres of crops with no insects or pests. It made farmers very happy and owners of the genetics very rich. Today, GMOs are planted on millions of acres of U.S. farmland. However, while the new technology killed many insect and weed pests, it did not kill them all. The ones that were not killed reproduced, and their offspring spread across the land. To compete against this new generation of resistant pests, GMOs were double and triple stacked with new capabilities. These new capabilities will kill many more pests, but not all of them, and thus the race is on between pests and pesticides. And so today we pause to ask, which will win the fight for our food, pests or pesticides? And who better to ask than Professor of Biology, Andy Dyer, who is the author of Chasing the Red Queen. Andy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
So pleased to have you aboard. So you're a professor of biology at University of South Carolina. I have a question. What the heck was that? Oh, there you are. I pressed the wrong button and got a buzz. Andy, I have a quick question for you with respect to your being a professor of biology. What question do students ask most when they first come in to study biology?
When they come in to study biology, I'd say the question asked the most is, what is it going to take for me to get to medical school?
How do I get out of this class successfully, right? Good to go.
Yeah, or I suppose the joke among professors is they'll always ask, what do I need to know for the test? The way I teach the class is, well, I don't do memorization. I do concepts. So you're going to have to know some concepts.
There you go. And one of the incredible concepts you came up with was, I just guess I wondered if anybody still asks about the birds and the bees when they came into your biology class.
They don't ask me.
They don't ask you. They probably talk about it among themselves then.
Yeah, I think they just figured out.
Okay, good. Well, one of the incredible concepts you came up with, this whole notion of chasing the Red Queen, and then you even wrote a book about it, which I have in my hands here, Chasing the Red Queen. Where did you come up with this notion? What was your epiphany moment when you thought of Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass?
Well, this comes from teaching ecology and evolution classes for about every year I've been here, which is 15 years, and much of what's in the book is what I cover in my class. And Just over the years, as we've had more and more discussions about this, it becomes really obvious that evolutionary biology is it sets the rules for how pesticides work. I mean, it's a very simple process.
When you talk about evolutionary biology, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I mean, if we go back to the basic concepts that, Darwin spelled out, that and it comes down to just five very simple things. Every population has some variation. Every population is capable of exponential growth. We all recognize that. But we're not up to our necks in bugs and beetles and frogs all the time. So that must mean that an awful lot of them don't actually make it. And that's probably in the neighborhood of 99.99%, you know.
Wow.
So that means that most of them die, and they have to be dying before they reproduce as well. Otherwise, we'd have all their babies. So those that live must be living for a reason. So he reached this realization that if most of them are dying and only a few are living, there must be something about them. They have the right stuff. But what is that stuff that enables them to live and pass on to their offspring? And he realized that it has to be something that they actually do pass on to their offspring. Now, he didn't know anything about genetics, but he was imagining that there had to be something. That's what we now call the genetics of each organism. They were passing on those traits, those genetic characteristics that enabled them to survive. And it's a very simple transfer then to go from that to how pesticides and pests interact with each other. To realize that we've just got the same situation, and we've got it. We demonstrated over and over and over that this works.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talked a little bit about the notion of this whole principle, evolutionary biology. It's not just biology, but it's also true in the business world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it carries over into a lot of different spheres, and that was the whole basis of the survival of the fittest sort of social philosophy of the late 1800s, that the best will survive and the weaker ones will disappear.
And, you know, there's been much talk lately, from the political realm at least, about the need for fairness of things. Is there fairness in biology?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it unfair. It's a very mechanical thing if you think about it. Bugs aren't thinking about what they need to do for the future, and they're not planning. They just are. They either die or they live, and those that live because they have the appropriate genetics for that particular situation, and their offspring will have those particular characteristics, and if the situation changes, then they won't. It's not a matter of fairness. It's just the way nature works. I think we come up with the concept of fairness when we apply it to human activities, but in nature, that's not fair or unfair. It's just the way, it's life. It's the way life manages to persist in an ever-changing environment.
Could the same be said for business, which is a human endeavor?
I think it can, and sometimes maybe should. That is, there are some businesses that have outlived their usefulness, perhaps, or perhaps aren't competitive in the current environment, or are sort of anachronistic and really belong to a different time. But there's also a lot of resistance among shareholders to ever let go of their...
And then they have access to the powers that be, and then there ends the fairness of the situation,
right. So if we think about subsidies, for instance, subsidies make it unfair because it allows an inherently weak system to survive the pressures of the modern day. If it had to fight on its own, would it still be able to survive? That's a very important question.
Is there such a thing as subsidies in nature?
I can't think of any. That's an interesting question. I'd have to give that some thought. I don't know how it would be applied.
Just a wild and somewhat crazy notion, I guess. And with respect to the whole principle of evolutionary biology, is there such a thing as a time when we did not have to chase the Red Queen? I mean, in our human history, haven't we always been, you know, fighting nature for our food?
I think as long as there's been agriculture, there's been a battle. It's just that the battle took a turn in a couple of different ways. As we began to bring in more and more non-native or exotic or new species that eat our crops, we began to run into more and more troubles. For instance, the boll weevil was introduced from Mexico in the late 1800s, and that sort of changed the cotton landscape for a lot of farmers. And they were so distressed, by the mid-century that they were looking for help from anywhere.
Pulling their hair out. We're going to have to take a quick break, Andy, but when we come back, I'd like to pick that up. Do organic farmers have to chase the Red Queen as well? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Professor Andy Dyer and you. We're talking about pesticides. Which will win the battle for our food in the future? Will it be the pests or will it be the pesticides? And when we say pesticides, of course, that's us. Do stay tuned. The phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program, and you are tuned in.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about pests and pesticides, the never-ending struggle for who or what will eat our food. If left alone in nature, perhaps we wouldn't get the food, but something else would eat it before we got there. So there's always this struggle, this competition between farmers and their pesticides and the pests and their appetite. Which will win the food? That's the subject today with Professor Andy Dyer, who is the author of Chasing the Red Queen. Andy, I forgot to ask one question. What about those of us who don't want to contend in nature?
With nature?
Yeah, or in nature. In nature.
Yeah, contending with nature versus sort of contending in nature.
Contending in nature. You know, we want to live in a fair world. We want to live in which everything is fair, and we don't want to contend.
I think that life as we know it, nature is a constant struggle for survival. Every plant out there ultimately is food for something else, and everything that eats those plants is probably food for something else, and on up the food chain, which is appropriate for this particular show. So there is this structure, this community structure of those that produce and those that eat the production and those that sort of control those that eat the production.
Kind of like,
I don't think there's any way out of it, although humans have tried to, divorce themselves as much as possible from that process.
That's okay. I was kind of wondering, we love to get to think of ourselves as somehow above and beyond.
Right.
And yet we're not really, are we?
Well, because we're trying to produce our food within that context, and that's a big part of the book that I wrote, is that trying to understand why it is that we can't be separate from nature, because we're trying to generate food from nature. And so that process of generating food means we have to play by the rules. The problem is that since the introduction of synthetic pesticides, we have tried harder and harder to not play by the rules. We want to basically call the rules as we see them, and we'd like to do it with the weapons that we have devised for trying to control pests.
Let me take you quickly to a look at the vast changes that have occurred in agriculture in just our lifetime. or at least some of our lifetimes. And I think of my grandparents' farm in Belfry, Montana, which is 320 irrigated acres of incredibly diversified agriculture. I think we had everything growing there, from animals to plants to orchards to trees to vegetable gardens. The whole thing was right there. Today, that 320 irrigated acres have been subsumed into a much larger farm that grows government-subsidized sugar beets. Now, on my grandparents' farm, there were no pesticides or chemical pesticides, mostly because Pop couldn't afford any. But the farm was so diversified that it didn't seem like anything was really ever got out of control. But not so in the monocrop of government-subsidized sugar beets, right?
Oh, absolutely. Farming has moved from the small, very diverse farm, as you've just described, to very large monoculture farms that grow one thing, and it's usually a commodity crop when we're talking about the large scale, but it doesn't really matter. We've gotten away from that diversity that supported the family and supported the local community, and quite often, ag products are now not even for the local area. They're for national distribution. So the whole intent of farming, the whole nature of farming has changed tremendously. But it's not just monocultures, you know. It's this reliance on, once you go to that very large scale, all of the insects that used to help, you know, lacewings and ladybugs and parasitic wasps and the pollinators, bees, they were already there. They lived in the neighborhood. They were on the other plants. They could overwinter on the bushes and the trees. They weren't dependent on any one thing. And so they were available, and you had this whole world out there helping you farm. And one of the reasons that your family probably didn't need as many chemicals to help them was they had the assistance of nature. But as that farm got larger and larger and went to one crop, absolutely, that farm was now becoming perfect conditions for explosions of very specific insects and weeds, those that love sugar beets. And then
think of all the sugar and sugar beets, right? Yahoo!
Well, and there are any number, if you know anything about sugar beets, there's just any number of things that will attack them. And so there has to be a heavy reliance on chemicals, because the helpful insects that would have controlled those pests are now farther and farther away from the crop, because the crop has become so big, 300 acres. So how far is it to the middle of 300 acres, would you say?
A long ways, yeah.
It's right.
For a bug to travel through sugar beet country, you know, and that's all the bug sees for miles and miles and miles is sugar beets. And if you're a beneficial looking for something else, you're not going to find it.
Right. It has to be just the right beneficial, and they have to travel quite a distance to find wherever the food, their food, which is the pest, wherever that food is growing. And so it's sort of a searching process. Until that pest population gets very large, the beneficial insects won't find it. By that time, you're probably already suffering damage to the crop. And so along come pesticides, and they are the answer to this problem. We can have very large farms. Monocultures, very simplified plants. Genetically, they aren't what they once were. That's okay, because we can handle those pests with pesticides. Unfortunately, we found very quickly in the 1950s that only works for a short period of time, and then insect resistance.
That's a real interesting time there, right in the 1950s, which would indicate to me that that's kind of like only a few years after World War II. Did World War II have anything to do with the development of pesticides?
Oh, it's tremendously important. The chemical breakthroughs that took place during the war years were instrumental in the modern world of pesticides. Not just chemical warfare, that was a small part of it, but just chemical breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs. Plus, we had vast amounts of materials for weapons that later got converted to peaceful purposes, and that became our fertilizer industry and a number of other things. So the time was ripe for this sort of explosion of technological advances to come to the assistance of agriculture.
So here we have 320 acres of just yummy sugar beets waiting for sugar beet hungry pests to come and eat them up. And so to protect them, all of the beneficials have been essentially chased out of the neighborhood because there's nothing for them to eat. So they move on. And so there's no protection from natural processes or organisms. You're left all on your own as a farmer to protect the crops. The only way you can do it is with pesticides.
Yeah. Well, and historically with the very diverse farm with much smaller plots of each crop.
You could go catch the bug by hand, right? Break its head off.
Yeah, it was a pretty diverse little farming ecosystem. And you've talked with guests before about ecosystem farming, which is very appropriate. Keeping all of those other components out there, maintaining your own level of diversity, well, that helps to maintain the diversity of the beneficial insects, too. And it keeps them right on hand, right nearby, where they can move in quickly and do their work. And all of that, as you say, is lost. And so farmers, whether they wanted to or not, became dependent on chemical assistance to control these outbreaks of pests. But the outbreaks happen because the farm is just a wonderful place for things that like that specific crop.
And so you either fight or you perish. You lose your crop if you don't fight. And so that takes us to the whole notion of chasing the Red Queen. The Red Queen, you say? Oh, yes. Think back to your childhood and Lewis Carroll Through the Looking Glass and Alice running with the Red Queen and never getting anywhere. And that's the subject of today's show. Can we get somewhere with pests and pesticides, or will it be a never-ending chase? That's the subject. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Andy Dyer, professor of biology at the University of Southern Carolina. And also the author of Chasing the Red Queen, all about fighting for our food. Do stay tuned. We'll be right back after these important messages. We all love to take a drive way out there in the country and cruise through the valleys of agriculture and look at those beautiful farms and think, oh, if I could just live on a farm like that, it would be so peaceful and so restful. But not so much. If you go and work on that farm, and you will have to contend with all kinds of organisms that want to eat the food that you are growing. And you're going to have to fight. You're going to have to contend with those critters, because if you don't, they will take your food, and it will be as simple as that. Fair, you say? Not fair at all? Well, maybe, maybe not. But is there really fairness in nature or business? Hard to find any. We try, but it doesn't seem to work out that way. So we must contend. And how do we contend? And that's the subject of today's program. Do we contend with pesticides, and where does that lead us? Andy Dyer, who is a professor of biology, says it leads us to chasing the Red Queen. What do you mean by chasing the Red Queen, Andy?
Well, as I've applied it to this particular case, and I borrowed it from a parasitology, what they were using it too. But the idea is that for every, let's say there's a predator and its prey. If the predator is doing a good job eating the prey had better adapt or they will go extinct. So they adapt, which means that the predator now has to chase something that's stronger or faster or better than it used to be. And they'd better get stronger or faster, and so they must adapt as well. And so as each one adapts, the other one counter-adapts, and this goes on and on and on. And there is no winning that race. It's just a race. So there isn't a finish line. There's just trying your best not to lose, really, more than anything else. I guess you could say there can be a loser, but there can't be a winner in that race.
So it really is like Alice says, you know, we keep running to the Red Queen, and the Red Queen says that's the way it is. We just keep running.
Right. So if we take the instance of pesticides and pests, a pest is eating our food, and so we apply a pesticide. And if we do this uniformly and we do this across large areas, it's absolutely inevitable that the pest is going to adapt to that pesticide. A pesticide really is nothing more than a stress. We've applied a stress, And the insect either adapts to that stress or it dies. And we found over hundreds and hundreds of examples that pests really don't die. They just adapt to it. They absorb it. They go on.
Individuals die.
Yes, individuals die, but some, a few of those individuals don't, and those that don't pass on their genes, their resistance traits to their offspring, and the offspring repopulate. And there we are, we're at it again. So this chase just goes on and on. Now, the difference with us is that as we use a pesticide, that pesticide becomes useless, and we have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a new one. And we don't have to come up with new pests. They're still there. It's the same pests we had before, but we have to come up with new chemicals.
But only they're smarter than they were before.
Well, they're better able to handle that one pesticide, but that pretty much rules that pesticide out of the game. So for 60, 65 years now, we've been trying to come up with better and better pesticides to battle the exact same insects and pests that we've always had to battle. And they're still there, and we're still struggling to figure out how to control them.
Well, aside from the contention with the bugs that are eating our crops, they say we now put about 1 billion pounds of pesticides in the environment here in the United States. I don't know how much they use through the rest of the world. I've been in places like the island of Cyprus and have come across, you know, a dump in a beautiful agricultural plateau that's just filled with empty cans of pesticides. So I assume that this pesticide use goes on all over the world. So we're probably using a lot of it to chase pests. What impact, if any, does that pesticide use have on the rest of the world?
Well, I think that's a good question because the race has become increasingly unbalanced, in my opinion. We're not playing the same game we did in the 1950s, where we were sort of naively going after boll weevils with DDT. Now we're triple stacking chemicals because we've realized that a single chemical won't do the job, so maybe a double or a triple stack chemical will. And I guarantee you the result will be the same eventually. But the consequences of using all of those chemicals are profound, and I don't think that... I think that we begin to fall farther and farther back in this race because we're damaging soil so tremendously. We're so reliant on fertilizers, which are toxic to most soil organisms. We have this tremendous reliance on chemicals and not on nature to help us. The monocultures and the genetic uniformity of our crops are just working against us in this whole process.
You know, you brought up a very interesting point there. Can we use pesticides to attack one pest without attacking all the rest of the critters?
I certainly think that's a possibility, but I don't think the industry is very interested in it. And that's because every pesticide, and Syngenta has published some calculations on this, every pesticide that they try to bring to market costs them over $200 million.
Ooh.
So they're much more interested in stacking traits, chemicals or traits within organisms like our crops, but then they are in coming out with individual chemicals for individual pests. That would cost them an enormous amount of money, and it would only be they would only be able to sell it to those farmers who were suffering from that particular pest. So, no, I don't think that's at all in the industry's interest.
So when we attack one critter, it's more likely we're attacking a whole bunch of critters.
Yeah, and so glyphosate has been the most popular chemical in history, probably, certainly in modern history, because it attacks every plant out there with few exceptions, but it kills weeds. But then it only takes one weed to become resistant, and you've lost the ability to use glyphosate, right? So in different places in the U.S., now the number is up to 32 different species are resistant to glyphosate.
All of them are becoming very, very smart. You know, I think that is really where I think we can help the audience understand this chasing the Red Queen business is the apogee of our ability to fight pests seems to be genetically modified crops in which we imbue crops with the genetics needed to pull really interesting tricks on nature. One of the tricks being to contain a Bacillus thuringiensis pesticide, wherein if an insect takes a bite out of a plant, any part of a plant, the insecticide, Bacillus thuringiensis, decomposes its stomach, as it were. And another one being we can imbue a plant with the genetics to withstand glyphosate, so that you can spray a whole field of glyphosate. With glyphosate and kill all the weeds and have no weeds. Man, this is incredible technology for agriculture. Farmers love it, and they have planted it, you know, fence post to fence post across the heartland of America. But, as you say, the bugs are catching on. And I think this is where we want to talk about the stacking of additional characteristics capabilities into these plants, because that is where we're at. Now, that's the latest technology in combating bugs, or chasing the Red Queen, as Andy Dyer would call it. And that's what he calls it in his book, Chasing the Red Queen, from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio program. When we come back, we're going to talk about triple stacking and what that means for our food and our ability to combat pests that want to eat our food before we eat our food. Do stay tuned. The phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with phone calls. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Andy Dyer, who is a professor of biology at the University of South Carolina. We have Rory calling in, and I'm so happy to hear that Rory's calling in, because he can put some fire into this program. But first, I wanted to ask Professor Dyer about the whole notion of stacking. You've talked about how we're now double and triple stacking things. What exactly does that mean, Andy?
Well, the biotech industry puts genes from different organisms inside crops, and those genes have different capabilities. So, like you say, the BT gene can create resistance to herbivores, and a gene that prevents the uptake of glyphosate would make it tolerant to glyphosate. Unfortunately, it doesn't really change the rules of the game any. It's still a chemical, and the bugs still have to overcome the chemical, and they do just exactly that, and the weeds do too. So the idea is that maybe if we put more than one gene in there, and there's two ways to do this. One, we can put different genes in that do different things, and so that would be triple stack, because there are three genes that do three completely different things. Or we could stack genes that do the same thing, and there's a very big difference between those two. The first one will fail just as fast as any chemical. And the second one has a greater chance of lasting longer. And that's the direction that I see some of these companies going now, is adding multiple genes for doing the same thing.
And what would that mean? For example, two different kinds of herbicides?
Well, not just two different kinds. They'd have to be, if they put in what's called different modes of action on herbicides. So if there are two genes that have different modes of action, that will fail just as fast as anything else, because the insect only has to overcome, or a weed that is susceptible to one of those genes only has to overcome that gene. But if the two genes have the same mode of action, then that weed would have to overcome both of them simultaneously, and that's a much more difficult proposition. In fact, according to the laws of probability, it's a tremendously more difficult proposition. Mm. And that's what the industry is banking on. Unfortunately, again, like this question you had about a pesticide that's very specific to one species, that's exactly what they have to do, unless they can come up with something like the glyphosate 2,4-D combination, which is sort of a double generic combination. It makes it much more difficult for resistance to emerge.
And yet, it does not change the rules.
It does not change the rules, and in fact, any weed that is already resistant to glyphosate really only has to overcome now the 2,4-D gene. And so there really is only one gene in there that's active in terms of that particular weed. So it has to be two new chemicals that the insects or weeds have never seen before. Otherwise, it really is just adding a new chemical onto an already failing system.
Okay, we're going to go to the phones right now, folks. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Rory on the line. Rory knows about plants. Welcome aboard, Rory.
Hey, thanks, Michael, for having me, and it's good to hear the professor here. These are issues that we live with, and I just wanted to speak to the strawberry industry, which I'm aware of, and I don't know if the professor knows, but here in California, we lost a miticide back in 1987 and going into the 1988 year, an influential researcher here in the valley decided, hey, we ought to try this predatory mite persimilis because we had no other good miticide alternatives. And he did. He connected with a Dutch insectary that raised them. We got them in here, and they worked. And they are the cornerstone of our IPM, integrated pest management strategies, and strawberries has become the standard. And this whole thing of genetic resistancers, and I don't want to go into all the details, but there are single dominant genes for resistance against insecticides, and then there's polygenetic. And the ones, the insects that have a single dominant gene against any chemical or active ingredient, they get resistant quicker and they maintain it more readily than a polygenetic resistance. So it's interesting. One of the reasons it prompted me to call is that we are looking for soft chemistries that are narrow spectrum, that are targeted to certain insects. So we got the mites covered with the predators. We've got some selective miticides that are targeted to two-spot mite and don't hurt our beneficial complex. Completely innocuous. They don't hurt the predatory mite as well. And we're looking, and I tell chemical reps, I said, find us, you know, narrow spectrum materials. And one guy at Dow, gosh, I think it was in the late 80s, found a bacterium under a rum still in the Virgin Islands. And it turned out it had activity against Lepidopteran pest and certain bugs. But we use it, and it's easy on the beneficials. And so there are those kind of chemistries out there, and we're telling them we don't want broad spectrum. I personally don't use, unless I'm in big trouble, I don't use broad spectrum chemistries. We use vacuums. I mean, we're mechanically sucking up pests.
Isn't that an incredible point, Andy, the whole notion of using broad spectrum things where we spray the same thing over vast tracts of land? I think what Rory was talking about was don't use those until you really get into trouble.
He's absolutely right. The broad-spectrum chemicals are the reason he had to go find a predatory mite to begin with, because the mites are arthropods. They're related to insects. So anything that's a broad-spectrum insecticide that kills a wide variety of insects will kill all of your spiders and mites as well, and mites are related to spiders. And so all of those very beneficial predatory organisms disappear overnight, and then the pests are back within weeks to months or the next year, but your predators are gone.
Rory, can you hold, Rory? I have to take a quick break. Can you hold?
Yes.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Do stay tuned. This is Food Chain, Andy Dyer and Rory and you. Holy smokes, it's the pests, and they're after us. We are back. There we are. And we have so much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in. So let's go straight to the phones. Rory, you want to finish up?
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, strawberries, the way they're cultivated in California, they lend themselves to this integrated pest management system. You know, it's a lot different than a 40-day spinach crop. And so I'm not trying to say that this is, you know, true across the board, but certainly for strawberries, there's much fewer harsh chemistries used by many consultants, and there is a beneficial insect population that literally comes on and blooms that was being missed in the old days when they just did the chemical intensive where they wiped everything out, and you had secondary, tertiary, and fourth.
Rory, would you say that we're doing a better job of chasing the Red Queen?
Oh, way better, because we're leveraging the beneficials. I mean, there's certain, pyrethroid chemistry can be used to combat white flies or mites, and people use them, and they might get a, you know, 30-day kill, but then all of a sudden they come back and they explode. Yeah, because you killed all the beneficials that were possibly keeping a lid on it. So, yeah. Anyway, great program. And
thanks for having us aboard, Rory. You're a great spokesperson for your industry. Really appreciate it. Let's go now to Doug. Doug, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning. You know, just to carry on with what Rory was saying, talking about what the cornerstone of the berry industry here is, I believe methyl bromide was supposed to be banned in the year 2005. And he was talking about, basically killing everything, which is what methyl bromide does. I would be very, and it's not, of course. I think that's really what the cornerstone of the successful berry industry is here at this point, since there's no alternative. But I'd be very interested to hear what the professor has to say. Although he lives back east there, I'm sure if he goes to the store, he's going to see some of our water back there in the form of berries.
Good question. Thank you very much, Doug. What do you think about the notion of soil fumigants, Andy?
Methyl bromide was, and I understand how, I lived in Fresno, I grew up in Fresno, and then got my PhD at Davis, so I'm familiar with the agricultural issues in California. We grow a fair amount of berries here in South Carolina, too. But methyl bromide is so destructive to the soil, and the soil is the foundation for agriculture. And any technology that ignores soil health is destined to failure. I'm absolutely sure about that. You must pay attention to soil health, and methyl bromide was so destructive. There are so many things. We think about the beneficial organisms as being above ground, but huge numbers of them are below ground. And keeping the soil healthy, keeping a good cover crop on the soil, not tilling the soil too much, all of those things contribute to maintaining that community and therefore maintaining the health of the crop as well.
So the big question, Andy Dyer, can we feed the world's burgeoning population without chasing the Red Queen?
I'll have to say, I'll end with saying that I think that corn and a couple other commodities are driving this bus. And when it comes to growing food and sort of arguing about pesticides and biotech, those are the ones that are sort of calling the shots, and everyone else almost has to get in line.
Corn and soybeans.
Yeah, cotton. I think we have to think about that. What is it that we want agriculture to do for us? What's the end game here? What's the long-term goal? And I think it needs to be sustainability. It needs to be protecting our land from further erosion and further degradation. I think we have to recognize that there is no silver bullet when it comes to pesticides and biotech.
Andy, thanks so much for tuning in, and thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.